Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of The Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, a nonprofit living laboratory for accelerating social change. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about our potential for creating visionary social change. I'm so pleased to welcome Jeff Mulgan as my guest on Making Change. Jeff has had a career filled with adventure and the opportunity to learn, from his youth as an angry teen to his time spent as a Buddhist monk, to directing the British government's strategy unit and serving as director of policy under British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Jeff's path has led him to a place that seems perfectly suited for someone of that vast array of experience as chief executive of NESTA, Britain's National Endowment for Science, Technology, and the Arts. Given both the breadth and depth of Jeff's experience, asking the big questions about what it is that creates social change, it is my pleasure to have Jeff Mulgan share his observations with us today here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is Jeff Mulgan. Thank you so much for being with us, Jeff.
Hi there.
Could you tell our listeners a little bit about the path that led you to the work that you're doing? What is the path of your life that brought you to your current work?
It's been a pretty winding path, I guess, like many people. I was brought up in London, was very much a political activist as a teenager, quite angry about many things around me. Spent a bit of time training as a Buddhist monk in Sri Lanka, driving vans, selling encyclopedias door to door for a while. I ended up working in bureaucracies. And in a way, my career has been a mixture of working within governments, so city governments, and then for a while in the UK national government, including as in charge of strategy and in charge of policy in a prime minister's office. And I still do quite a bit of work with governments around the world, so looking at things top down. But I've always also tried to do the opposite, which is starting up social enterprises, civil society campaigns, and projects. And I guess I iterate between the two, and I think both give you insights into how change happens. I tend to find the bottom-up stuff much more satisfying, but always when you're involved in grassroots stuff, you also want to tap into where the real power is, the real money is, and you know if you can't do that often, it's very hard to achieve lasting change.
So what led you into NESTA?
Well, NESTA is a very unusual organization set up about 15 years ago with money from the lottery in the UK, with a very broad remit to back innovation. And like many sister organizations around the world, that used to mean just technology innovation. You get the next generation of, I don't know, pharmaceuticals or nanotech or whatever. But NESTA, like, say, our counterparts in countries like Finland or Canada or Chile, has moved much more to trying to think about innovation in a broader sense. It's as much about what happens in charities, in civil society, in the public sector, as it is about what happens in big technology companies or science parks. And the chance of having some money, some resources to play with, but to use to back innovation excited me a lot. And what we do now straddles everything from quite commercial investment in early stage companies with a really great technology, through doing programs in fields like healthcare or schools, or a big program we're running at the moment on innovations in giving. How do you give money or time or collaborative consumption, through to quite a strong emphasis on research and finding out what really works, what really has impact. And to me, in a way, it's a dream job to have the capacity of both money, but also of a really bright, committed group of people and a fair amount of latitude as to what we do with those resources.
That sounds like so much fun.
It is. And in a way, when I came to NESTA, having spent the last 4 years setting up an organization called the Young Foundation, which was in some ways in a similar space, and which had been the legacy of a man called Michael Young, who was one of the world's original social entrepreneurs back in the 50s and 60s. He was a pioneer of the idea of social entrepreneurship, and I think set up probably more organizations than almost anyone else around the world, some civic, some public, some commercial. In his 80s, he was selling companies to venture capital, and the open universities he set up now have hundreds of millions of students worldwide. Our limitation at the Young Foundation, we didn't have really an endowment resources. So NEST in some ways is a chance to do similar things to what we were doing there, but with a reasonable financial base.
Well, given everything and the breadth of everything that you have been involved in and the breadth of what you're currently involved in, when you see change happening in small communities globally, what are the factors that you see that are embedded in that? What is creating change?
I've just brought out a book this month, in fact, from which Princeton University Press has published. We try to have a chapter asking exactly this question: how do we think about long-term patterns of change and what really drives them? And I'm sure I don't have a perfect answer to that question by any means. What really strikes me, if I think of what's changed in 20 or 30 years around me, the big changes around how we think about, let's say, waste or the environment or energy or disability rights or very different views about what healthcare means compared to 20, 30 years ago. These changes are nearly always pretty slow. They're pretty steady. They involve an enormous number of people in different fields, from community activists to academics to campaigners to policymakers. And it's the combination of the work of millions of people which I think leads to change. Now, on the ground, it often depends on particular individuals who, with grit and determination and anger and unwillingness to take no for an answer and so on. And a lot of my day-to-day work is dealing with those sort of people and helping them, I guess, break down the barriers around them and not get disheartened. But if you stand back, what really strikes me about change is how organic it is. And all those sort of accounts, and in a way that the heroization of individual change agents, which got very fashionable here in the 90s and I think in the States as well, in some ways is deeply misleading. Change is very rarely just about heroic, charismatic individuals sort of seeing with a clear vision how everything needed to be different and then everyone else followed them. It's not like that in my experience at all. It's actually a much more collective, much more ecological process, which we're parts of. And I think often we're the most effective as we're parts of change if we sublimate the ego a little bit and don't try and become individual heroes, but realize we're parts of far bigger waves in which we are tiny fragments.
It's interesting, as I've looked at that over time, I've actually found a very, very similar thought, that not only is the heroization, I love that word, misleading, but it's almost counterproductive, because we look at somebody like a Gandhi or like a Martin Luther King or a Nelson Mandela, and we say, these are special people, I will never be like that, therefore I have no impact. And I find it very counterproductive.
It's very interesting in relation to innovation, where you get exactly the same thing happens. From a distance, it looks like innovation is driven by incredibly creative, brilliant individuals. And we use sometimes in our training classes the example of the iPod, because most people out there think the iPod was invented by this guy called Steve Jobs, who had some unique genius which enabled him to see things other people couldn't see. Mm-hmm. When you look closely at the iPod, what he had done was pull together a whole bunch of innovations from other people, music technologies from Germany, previous generations of digital musical devices in California. iTunes was basically taken from Napster. The underlying sort of structures were substantially developed by Foxconn, the manufacturer in China. And all Steve Jobs did was put it together very cleverly, but not a single element was original. And I think the same is true in social change, that from afar, the leaps forward made by a Gandhi or a Martin Luther King or perhaps a Muhammad Yunus look like dramatic steps. But when you look very closely at what they did, they were much more incremental, much more about pulling together elements which were already there, things other people were doing. And so we try and present innovation, and we're providing online and in courses all sorts of tools to help people be good innovators, and we try and demystify it. And so actually nearly all of those steps are very accessible. Any group of citizens or teachers or nurses can actually be very, very creative with the help of these tools, and they don't have to believe this is out of their reach and you need to be a unique genius to do it.
I'm curious how you're building that synthesizing element into those tools.
Well, we've been doing this over several years, and I guess this is partly a reaction to what happened a decade or so ago in countries like the UK, where me and many people, I guess, involved in social projects got a little bit tired of the endless succession of conferences which just showcased stories, essentially. Mm-hmm. Charismatic individuals telling an audience about the amazing things they'd done. Now, often they were amazing things, and many of these people are my heroes. But that tended to leave this message that you had to be a hero to achieve a change. It was perversely disempowering. So we started a project looking at the methods being used for social change and social innovation around the world. And we documented some of these, and a few years ago published a thing called the Open Book of Social Innovation, which had 600 methods being used from Brazil and China to Denmark, the UK, the US. And they ranged across a huge diversity of tools, from theatre to financing tools to design methods, research methods, scaling methods, and so on. And we've tried to then go a step further and make these easily accessible through a mixture of online self-learning tools, through case studies, and through running training sessions, which we've done now all over the world, bringing together people both from the grassroots and social entrepreneurs, but also people within, let's say, city administrations or national governments or banks, the people who can either help or hinder them, to provide a common language of really how does innovation happen? How do you start with understanding a need, a problem, or indeed an opportunity, a new technology which might help? How do you then turn that into ideas? How do you generate lots of ideas rather than just a few? How do you try them out in practice? How do you turn them into a business model or a public policy? How do you see if it's actually working? How do you scale it? And then how do you transform whole systems? And in every step of the way, it's trying to get rid of the jargon, get rid of the hype, just get down to the basics. What's actually going on here? What really works? And in so doing, I hope to demystify innovation and to democratize it, to say this is something we should all be part of, we should all be owning. You don't need to pay a clever design consultancy to do this for you. You don't need to wait for a very clever central government bureaucrat to do it for you either. Let's co-own the task of recreating the world.
That is language that resonates. It is absolutely language that resonates. Do you have any stories, any examples of what you've seen as a result of that?
Well, let me give an example, just because I spent a bit of my morning today working on it. In some ways, it's quite a modest example involving schools, which is not part of Nesta, but is a project I'm involved in sort of outside Nesta. This was prompted 5 or 6 years ago, as so many social innovations are, by something not working. In this case, it was lots of teenagers in the UK still basically dropping out of school, not leaving with qualifications, not being engaged at all. And there had been innumerable policies sort of thrown at the school system, which basically hadn't worked for one in 10, maybe 1 in 20 mm-hmm. pupils. Mm-hmm. We then spent a lot of time with teenagers, with teachers, with others, trying to think what kind of school really would really motivate these sort of people to get involved. And we quite quickly came up with a very different idea about schooling, partly inspired by some models elsewhere in the world, in Brazil, Colombia, Paraguay, India, and also Australia was a particular school which inspired me. And very like what I described Steve Jobs doing with the iPod, we put together a combination of these elements in a new way. None of them were original, but putting them together was original. We called it a studio school, where most of the learning would be done through real-life practical projects, working with real-life partners or clients in the community. And those could be a small business or a charity or a municipal authority. Following precisely the tools of innovation, which I described a moment ago, we sort of try to generate lots of different variants, lots of different options. We field tested much of the model in real schools around the UK. We quite quickly found the key insight I think we had was right, that people learned much better when there was a real life task rather than sitting in a classroom, and that through those tasks you could learn your English and your maths and your science but as it were woven into the projects rather than through reading textbooks. We've now got 15 of those schools open here, another 15 open in September. And this week we've been going through the interview round for another wave of schools to open next year. I hope another 15 or so will open next year. Now, this is still a small number of schools. We'll have maybe 50 next year out of a total of 4,000 secondary schools here in the UK and hundreds of thousands worldwide. But it's a model which I hope over several decades could truly become global. We've had interest from all over the world in setting up schools like this. We've taken it pretty slowly, pretty gradually. We've kept it below the radar of the media. We don't go around conferences talking about it very much. We're absolutely certain it works. And there are some things we got wrong, undoubtedly, which we've tried to fix. But I hope it's not only an example of healthy social change around a really key issue, lack of opportunity and engagement for teenagers. But what's for me really inspiring, because I went to visit one of the schools this morning, is in a way we're teaching the teenagers to be change agents themselves. Right. That by running these projects, in a way we're teaching them agency, that you can actually shape things. Your being in a school isn't just about learning the stuff which is in the textbook, it's about learning how to be part of your society, how to be part of your economy, and to make things for yourself. And that ideally we want the kids to leave school at 18 or 19 with that real sense of confidence that the world is there to be made and shaped by them. And that turns out to be not so hard. Amazing. And every time I sit with the schools, I come across these teenagers and they are much more impressive than I certainly was at that age in terms of their confidence that they are change makers and shapers of the world around them.
It's so interesting. I can't tell you how many times in a week I say, you know, I think we've made things a lot harder than we have to. The answers are so much easier when we sort of break things down. One of the things that I've observed over time in the work that we've been doing at Creating the Future is that when we look at scale and replicability, as you're about to do with this program, that where we fail with replication is when we try to replicate the exact model of what we have done, because environments are different. And so what we do in different environments is going to be dramatically different. So when we try to replicate the steps of what we did, we're sort of bound to either fail or wind up adapting beyond all recognition. But when you're scaling and replicating a thought process, I think that's really what you have embedded here, because I'm noticing many different questions that you raised here that are not the standard questions. The first thing you did was you looked at what kind of school would motivate people to get involved. It's asking a different question. It's asking the question of how do people engage in their own process, whether it's a school or anything else. And so it's really interesting to me that what you're sort of finding is that it's the thinking, it's not the doing.
Yeah, and I think there's some basic questions we're trying to get into nearly all of our work. The first question is, have you got the right question? And often I think it's more important to get to a really good question and spend more time on that rather than jumping to an answer. And maybe just to give one example on that, when I worked in government, one of the first things I was asked to work on by the Prime Minister was cutting numbers of people sleeping rough on the streets of the cities in the UK, street homelessness. Mm-hmm. At first, it looked like the problem was street homelessness. And if it's street homelessness is the problem, then you open up hostels and things like that for homeless people to go into. But it very quickly becomes clear that's not the right question. Homelessness, the sleeping on the streets, is usually a symptom of a whole host of other issues, from mental health problems, alcoholism, drug addiction, family breakdown. And if you want to solve the problem, you've got to go upstream and deal with those and not just deal with a symptom, which is people sleeping rough on the streets. And so we designed a whole sort of strategy for dealing with everything from discharge from prisons and the army, all the way through to helping people not just off the street and into a hostel, but also into help with their drug addiction or help in getting a new skill. And as a result of that, actually did bring down the numbers sleeping on the streets by about 90%. So it was a very successful program. New York, a few years later, copied some elements of it quite successfully. the starting point was asking the right question. And many of the people in the system, including the NGOs, found that very uncomfortable because they were comfortable just dealing with the symptom, which was homelessness, rather than going upstream. The other question I always try and get us to ask, and my colleagues, is who elsewhere in the world has actually thought about this in a creative way? And in the past, in the UK, we used to think we were the font of wisdom, or at best we'd look at other English-speaking countries like the US. It's only in the last year, so 10 years, that we've started becoming better, I think, at learning from Korea or Bangladesh or Brazil, and being really open to the insights of the world. And I think a big difference I notice in different countries is that some now almost take it for granted. That's the first thing you do, is you learn from the best, wherever they may be, whatever language they speak. And there are other parts of the world which are still basically insular and only really listen to people in their own country. And for sort of imperial countries like the UK, and I think the US as well, this is quite hard. Culturally, it's unusual to really be in learning mode. But for so many of the issues we're dealing with, you have to start there by asking, who's thought this through better than we have?
I really love that link between the imperial attitude and the sense that we have the answer, because that really was so much of a part of colonization over hundreds of years, is we have the right way of living and we have the right way of life. And we have the answer goes directly counter to, we're going to spend an hour, which we frequently actually do in our board meetings. It's so fun at Creating the Future board meetings, where suddenly after an hour, somebody will say, we finally found the question. And we're excited about that, because the answers are a dime a dozen once you've got the question. So it does go culturally against an attitude of, we have the answer, versus we're going to spend time and look for the question.
Yeah. And in so many of the really fundamental stories of social change, it's a different mentality, it's a different almost in frame of interpretation, which is the truly transforming thing. I mean, take carbon reduction. Seeing the world in terms of carbon is a completely just different way of seeing everything we do. And just didn't occur to people 30 or 40 years ago. But in a way, it's that idea which has been more transformative than any particular technology. And I think that relates to the point you were raising earlier about replication. We've done a lot of work over the years on funds and tools and methods for scaling and replication, but increasingly have come to the view that we've got our metaphors slightly mixed up. And this is partly because, again, probably 10 or 20 years ago, a lot of NGOs wanted to copy business. They thought that they should be scaling just like, you know, Microsoft did, or General Motors or Toyota. And I used to go to endless events where they were sort of feeling they should be like businesses. And the best way to scale was to grow a really big organization with a standardized product, which was, you know, the same everywhere, like, you know, a Google or Toyota. In fact, if you stand back and look through the other end of the telescope and ask, what have been the really big social changes which have affected people's lives? Much more often, they've come through almost horizontal spreading and replication rather than through particular organizations. So transformed ideas around disability, or equal opportunities, or recycling, or urban farming, all of these movements are much more defined by people copying what others have done, but still keeping their organizations quite small, rather than by creating massive new multinational organizations. And the really big global NGOs are not, in fact, really associated with ideas or social transformation. So I think there was a kind of, there was a category error made by a lot of the people involved in social change 10 or 20 years ago, when they thought that scaling, which is essentially a manufacturing concept, was the thing to apply to social issues, whereas probably we needed a much richer language of growth and spreading, where more often that growth would come through sort of networks of often quite small, rooted, localized organizations, learning from each other, copying elements, but not trying to become some great monolith.
What's interesting about that is I spend a lot of time working with groups, and the question is often raised, shouldn't we be running like a business? What do you do? What is a business model that makes sense? And the thought that has come to me, aside from the very glib, which business do you really want to run like, with so many businesses as the model of what's wrong in the world and looking at the financial industries, and there's the glib joke about that. But the reality is that the vast majority of businesses and the vast majority of successful businesses are small businesses. And if we look at what makes small businesses successful, it is very similar to what makes grassroots efforts successful, whether it's an organization, a social enterprise, whatever, that small businesses can't exist on their own. They exist in collaboration with others. I mean, you just sort of go down the list of what works in a small business, and that is way more scalable in that horizontal way that you're talking about.
Having worked for both big businesses and big governments and with big NGOs, size always brings with it bureaucracy, formality, process, hierarchy, all sorts of not particularly pleasant things. It brings other virtues. You know, you can get lots of things done. You can often attract really clever people. But I don't think we should make a cult of scale. You remember E.F. Schumacher wrote this book, but it was 30, 40 years ago, Small is Beautiful, which had enormous influence advocating the virtues of relatively small size and sustainability. He did also say, though, that if in a world of small organizations, he might have written a book called Big is Beautiful, because you sometimes need a mix of different scales for different things. But I think it's quite wrong to only aspire to bigness. And for any NGO or social enterprise which wants to get big, and there are often good reasons for wanting to get big, one of the things I say to them is think very clearly about why you want to be big and how you want to be big. Because nearly always when an organization grows substantially, in order to grow, it has to change its internal culture, its accountability arrangements. Usually it has to get rid of the leaders who are right for the early stage, but not right for becoming big. And a whole set of things usually have to change, which are pretty uncomfortable. And people always assume that they will keep, as it were, the spirit, the feel, the motivation they have as a small organization and simply amplify that 100 times. It's never like that.
Yeah, it's sort of like thinking that life isn't going to change after you have a baby. It's going to change.
Yeah.
One of the things that's occurring to me as we're talking, and I hope you and I can continue this conversation another time, because you're just sparking a lot of things for me. What I'm realizing is that it is anathema to think that big organizations are the ones that can create change in the world. We may aspire to be the Microsoft of social change, but the reality is that you were saying before that big organizations sort of get set in their ways. They bureaucratize, they systematize. That goes directly counter to walking a talk of disruption and innovation and being that. I mean, there is that discomfort. If there's discomfort in changing in order to grow and be a bigger company, there's certainly going to be disruption in changing in order to create change. And so it's really interesting to think that we've sort of assigned this thought that a big organization is going to be the one to create change when they're the ones that are the most change averse.
Yeah, this is one of the things I've written about in this book. It's called The Locust and the Bee, which is about predatory and creative aspects of the modern economy and society. And one of the things which sparked me to write the book was a sense that we are now at this point, 5 years after the financial crisis, when we will soon start shifting from just worrying about how do we get back to the world before the crisis. And all over the world, you know, our governments are still basically trying to sort of put the pieces back together again, which somewhat shattered in 2008, 2009. I think we'll then move forward to a much more creative period of social redesign. And that's what happened after past financial crises, like in the 30s and before that in the 1870s. In the initial years after the crisis, as I say, there was chaos and confusion and angst, and everyone tried to rebuild the old order. And only after that had failed did they then look at much more radical reshaping of the world. And in particular, I think we're in a period where many of our fundamental systems are clearly dysfunctional. They're run by large organizations, as you said, many of which were incredibly successful in the past, but their very success has repeated itself until it's become failure, as often happens. The food system is a really good example of that. Phenomenally effective now at producing food cheaply, but now producing mass epidemics of obesity and in these business models, which depend on pumping, you know, sugar into cereals and actually making people much less healthy, less nourished than they should be. And it's an industry, Mars, parts of which can't really escape from this. We still have a finance industry which got completely sidetracked into basically extracting value out of its customers rather than helping them. And I think still hasn't really learned the lessons of what went wrong there. We have a health system all over the world, which I think is still locked in a now very anachronistic model of healthcare based around hospitals and cure, where nearly all the key pressures on health are about long-term conditions and chronic disease. And because our health systems are so inefficient in the US, the forecast now suggests that half your entire economy will go into health by the latter part of this century. But in a way, that's a symptom of these sort of almost massively dysfunctional systems which can't even see their own failures and then get locked into these pathological behaviours. And it will be the outsiders who will see what needs to be done, not the insiders. And hopefully we'll find the routes in to unravel the old systems. But I mean, the final point there is that unraveling will be a combination of the work of often very small organizations and social entrepreneurs, but also of, at some point, people on the inside in governments and policy and regulation and tax, changing the wiring of the system so that it flips around and starts creating genuine value for people rather than destroying it.
Well, Jeff, I wish our time was not up. I'm so loving the line that you said just a couple of minutes ago, talking about a radical reshaping of the world. And I am hoping that in the next several months, we can get back together, have another conversation, because I would love to explore what that radical reshaping can look like. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Hildy.
Listening to Jeff, I'm struck by the simple logic of his observations, logic that flies in the face of so much of the current popular wisdom and still feels infinitely, well, logical. The popular wisdom encourages us to believe that organizations and enterprises must not only be strong enough, but also large enough before they'll be able to make any significant difference. The truth, though, across centuries and millennia, is that large organizations become, as Jeff noted, bureaucratic and hierarchical, and far more bent on their own self-perpetuation than the creation of serious disruptive change. Once an organization becomes large and powerful, creating disruptive change is frequently the last thing on their mind. If the popular wisdom about large and powerful isn't the answer, then what is? Jeff talked not only about the nimble power of small is beautiful, but also about the power of individuals and groups learning from each other, working together in what he called organic networks. Real people working on the things that affect their own lives, having power and agency over their own future and their own present. Again, simple logic. The story Jeff shared about the Studio School Project mirrored so many of the stories of past guests on this show, from John McKnight and Peter Block, to on-the-ground work being done by activists like Alana Shaikh and Brett McNaught. It's the power of having people act in their own agency on behalf of themselves, bringing them together to engage people in their own process, a far different approach than an organization or enterprise believing they are the experts, that they have the answers to bestow upon the people. Jeff also talked about the power of asking a different question, the power of looking beyond the question that presents itself to the question of root causes, or as we ask at Creating the Future, looking to create what is possible when that issue is behind us. If we're going to consider a radical reshaping of the world, as Jeff so wonderfully put it, it will take, as Jeff also put it, co-owning the task of recreating that world. Which leads to questions for your own work. What would it make possible if, like Jeff noted about Steve Jobs and the iPod, if your first question in building a new project was, who's already working on parts of this? What would it make possible if instead of seeing them as competition, you spoke with others doing similar work to see what you could learn from each other? And what would it take to make those conversations happen? Second, as you're thinking about a new project or program, how might you engage people in building that program together with you so that their wisdom is built into that effort? As you address the needs and desires of your community, are you being the hero, the expert, or are you working side by side with the people who will benefit from that work? And what would it take for you to be able to do so? And lastly, how might your strategies be more effective if the first question you spent time pondering was, do we even have the right question? What would your organization need to believe or feel to be comfortable spending time questioning the question instead of finding answers to what might be an incomplete question. What would you need to have in order to take the time to find that right question? As you begin exploring these big questions, I hope you'll share your observations at Creating the Future's Facebook page at facebook.com/creatingthefuture. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me through our website at creatingthefuture.org or on Twitter at Hilde Gottlieb. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you next month here on Making Change.